Sean. Hey, Radcast is on.
And welcome to the show, Mr. Jim Zumbo.
Gentlemen, I am pleased to be here, and I use that term loosely when I say gentlemen.
Al Winder. Just want to welcome you to the show. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with us on a podcast for a little bit.
Hey, I'm looking forward to it. There's nothing makes me happier than a cold in Minnesota. If I can't be out fishing, I should be talking about fishing.
Hailing from Wisconsin, Jana Waller.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's Radcast. Hunting, fishing, and everything in between. Powered by Bow Spider.
Brought to you by PK Lures and High Mountain Seasonings.
And now, here's your hosts, Patrick Edwards and David Merrill.
Hello and welcome, everybody. We are on an episode of Radcast on the Road. David and Bow Spider are hanging out. We're down in Salt Lake at another trade show. It's the International Sportsman's Expo this time. It's a good time. It's been great. Lots of people have been here. I have managed to grab somebody that I have been following for a little while, and I think you guys will really enjoy this guest. He's had quite an experience and adventure in the outdoors. Pretty varied skills, lots of different avenues and businesses and experience. Mr. Rick Young has been TV host, serial entrepreneur, and big game hunter extraordinaire. So welcome to the show, Mr. Rick Young.
Hey, I appreciate just the opportunity to be here and talk to your audience. This is great, right here in Salt Lake City with you. Doesn't get any better.
So we're gonna start right here really easy. Let's go all the way back. What was the first real spark that got you into the outdoors? Where did you get your passion for what you've done?
That came early, like with a lot of guys. You get exposed to hunting when they're 12 years old and get hooked. And later in life, opportunities come and go. And I had the chance to hook up with a buddy of mine to start a show called Northwest Hunter TV prior to the Outdoor Channel even existing. So TV, hunting on television was taboo at that point. And Bill Jordan and Babe Winkleman and all the old guys, they were cutting their teeth into programming, and finding a network to carry a show was not easy to do back then. And we pulled it off, and then along comes the Outdoor Channel, and they're like, hey, we actually enjoy your show. We're going to pay you for it. Whole new concept, right? You're like, oh, you're going to pay us for it. Boy, did that tide turn around where you ended up having to buy your airtime over time. But we were extremely successful and reached an audience of about 110 million households, and had all the fortunate ability to pull in all the big sponsors from Valvoline to Swarovski, Mossy Oak, and Federal Ammunition, Remington Arms, and the list goes on, but great opportunities.
It's cool to meet you, talk to you, share, and you've got so many stories, I don't even know where we're gonna incorporate all of them, but to see the transition while we're on the TV filming, I've put some films on YouTube for free. We've talked about this at length. You got to be what I would call is the heyday, where people are coming to you to sponsor you. And then when the Outdoor Channel comes on, they're like, hey, we want your program. Instead of you having to pay for the airtime, they're buying your program.
That's true. Yeah.
That's all gone away. It's all gone the way of the dodo for sure. And nobody has a TV show anymore.
And early on, the sponsors were unsure of television because the outdoor industry never advertised on television. It was unheard of. They didn't even know if it would work. They knew print ad worked, but they didn't know if TV would work. So it was an adventure for them. And as your audience knows, that grew and got to be Men's Channel, Sportsman's Channel, Pursuit Channel, America One Network. They go on. The list is huge. And there was a vacuum for it. And as the internet grew, then as streaming grew, as prices of cameras dropped from, say, we had $100,000 in a Betacam 400SP that was unheard of. Nobody could afford a camera like that, so there wasn't a lot of people in the industry. Then camera prices popped up with digital cameras for $6,000 that were decent, right? And they just kept getting cheaper. Everybody could do it. That's what happened. And for some reason, the audience accepted a jittery, less quality production. And whips and stops. And there's a rule. You don't take a camera scene and spin the audience around. you can only go so far. You can only go 180 degrees. Anything beyond that, you are not a good producer. Today, it's 360 degrees. Hang on. Buckle up in your seat because this TV programming is going to spin you around.
Oh, and we use GoPros. We use drones. And we give you all sorts of crazy angles on our YouTube stuff now.
Yeah, it's acceptable. And it's easier to produce as well.
So what was the very first memorable hunt pre-TV? What got you involved in the outdoors?
That would be a Marlin 3030, lever action, mule deer. And boom, I was hooked, right? And at 12, that was a pretty big experience.
Who was your mentor to get you started in that?
That'd be my parents. Yep, that'd be my parents. And my parents only hunted deer. That was it. They didn't hunt elk. They didn't hunt any other species, a few pheasants and whatnot. But I exploded on it. And every day was hunting. If the weather was right after school, I was hunting. I was stuffing rabbits and doing my own taxidermy before I knew what that was. And it was a natural. But then I took photography in school, too. So cameras were not foreign to me. I could run up camera. And I was dangerous. So the cameramen would say I was too damn dangerous because I'd watch what they're doing and figure it out. Next thing, they're if they didn't want the shot, I'd take it anyway.
So you're editor, producer, star, and now you're like, hey, I can also run the camera. So if you're not going to run it the way I want it ran, we're just going to replace you. I'll hit the record button.
Yeah, so we'd hired professional editors for the show. It was well done, but the editors were not hunters, and it showed. And it didn't take long. We'd bought an Avid system, and away I go. Now I'm editing the programming as well as hosting.
How many total shows do you think you've captured? How many total hours of footage do you think you have?
Total hours of footage is, I couldn't even begin to put a number on it, but completed shows was 350 half-hour episodes, and that doesn't include all the commercials we produced and all the special programming that we produced.
So in a typical half-hour show,
What was the ratio?
I assume you're going on a 7, 5, 10 day hunt for a specific species.
Sure.
You're filming every day. And so let's say you're capturing an hour of footage a day on a 7 day hunt.
Yeah, that's reasonable. We're going to come out of there with 6 to 12 tapes as tape at the time.
And you're going to edit that all the way down to 22, 27 minutes.
If you're efficient, you could do that in 40 hours. You're married to the project, you're going to spend twice that on it because you want it perfect, right? And the secret to outdoor programming is quality audio. A lot of guys shooting off the boom mic or something are picking up all the ambient sound. And we went right to the electrosonic mics and spent some good money, and it made a difference.
That's been probably the bane of our films is audio. We've got the video captured, we've got the kill shot, we've got the essence of the story. But if the wind's blowing and you don't have the mic going, or the mic dies, and now you're trying to rely back on the road mic, on the shotgun mic on the camera, it's getting everything. And
it's horrible.
People complain about our films where the audio isn't mixed. And I don't think they realize how much time, effort, and energy goes into.
Oh, yeah. And on television, you've got levels of lighting. You've got levels of color that you have to get right. It's not like the internet. You had to produce something that met the standards.
So of all the hunts you've done, is there anything that's a little bit taboo?
Taboo? Yeah, you might say some people don't think you should hunt African male lion or rhinos or grizzly bears anymore, polar bear anymore. The information the public has on the species count is skewed like everything else today with the political world. And like I had a nice hunt in Africa for a lion, and the village was thrilled, just thrilled that we killed this older cat. And they stripped the meat. It's a dark red meat. It's not like a puma or mountain lion where the meat is more white. They stripped it. I helped them strip it. We hung it up on the clothesline, and they dried it out, and it's good for months.
It's got natural biltong African style, and I've been entertaining the thought of going over and helping them with one of their problem cats as well. And that's definitely, as we know in this political environment, very, very taboo, I would say.
Yeah, it is.
But you ask anybody there, they're glad that lion's gone,
yeah,
for sure.
They're thankful. And they're protecting the species as well because they know it means money. They want the lion, but they want the hunter, and they want the cash. I'd done an elephant hunt once that the money went to the schools. They had, in Zimbabwe, they had over 80,000 plus elephant, and the area wouldn't sustain that. The fruit trees are all knocked down. Elephants are knocking telephone poles down. It's a problem. So they're going to go out and cull them. And somebody said, whoa, time out. Let's reduce these numbers and put a special sale on, say, a toothless hunt. 10% of the elephants don't have tusks. So they got to get mean in order to survive. And they decided that they were going to eliminate that because it's a genetic issue. And for $5,000, you could come hunt elephant. The village loved the hide, they loved the meat, and the money went directly to the school systems to teach these kids English. And it was a win, I'm telling you.
It is a win, and it's you're touching on the North American conservation model, and we could come up, between you and I, 4 hours of content discussing all the species that have been brought back from the brink due to this model. I want to dig a little deeper and ask you, what is your thoughts about the recent headline coming out of California saying that the North American wildlife model, conservation model, is now outdated and needs to be reformed? And they essentially say they want to eliminate the hunting portion, they want to eliminate the tags, the licensing. What would you say to somebody who doesn't understand the model and doesn't understand that when they hear that kind of rhetoric coming out of, this is coming from Game and Fish out of California?
Yeah, it's hard to understand their thought process, where they got that model from, because all the funding that's created the rebound of the species has come from the sportsman's tax. Every time you go into a sporting goods store and you buy something, there's a federal tax. That money is going to perpetuate the habitat for these animals.
And also pays for the game wardens. It pays for any habitat management, disease inoculation. All that funding comes not from the house taxing. It comes from sportsmen with a self-imposed tax.
Yeah, and the thing is, I don't think these individuals are really looking to protect the animal. They're really looking to eliminate the hunter. That's their whole goal. And if they can take away your ammunition, or they can take away your right to hunt and blame it on a species count or something, they're going to work their angles to get to where they want to go. And the bottom line is, I feel that if they eliminate the opportunity to hunt, they're going to eliminate the capital that they're raising. And therefore, now there'll be no more habitat money available for seeding and for water projects and all that. That'll all go away.
Weed mitigation projects, all those things are going to be gone the way of the dodo, because there will be no funding. And when I hear those things, I cringe just to my core because of how I understand this model works, and seeing it boots on the ground working, whether I've been Africa, whether I've been here in North America. Guys, if the background noise is too bad, I'm sorry. Hopefully we'll have that cut out or edit out. We'll just keep continuing on. So I don't want to get too deep into trying to convince people that the North American wildlife model of conservation is good, but you've had a lot more experience seeing all these facets and seeing, you know, in your lifetime.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, Africa, it's also Zimbabwe. I mean, Tajikistan, those are locations I've hunted. And those people are existing off of a shoe thread of money. Their whole family lives in a home that's the size of a 25 by 30 foot home. You've got grandma and grandpa, you've got the kids, you've got the grandkids, you've got the great grandkids all living in a building that the sheep hides are laid on the floor for insulation. And it's 30 degrees, minus 30 degrees outside. And me and my buddy chose to sleep in a tent outside because the house was overcrowded. They thought we were crazy, but they were treating us like royalty just because we had gone there to hunt and pay a fee. So much. Let me explain. Their livestock is their livelihood. When a man gets married, if he has a herd of sheep, then they feel he's wealthy. Okay, so I was pretty honored when we went into camp. They don't even know we're coming, and we show up and they say, yes, you're welcome to stay with us. And The gentleman went out and grabbed a sheep, sliced his throat on the porch, caught the blood, gutted him, took the guts in, and made soup that night. And you couldn't go, the ritual was you could not go to bed until you ate the soup. And this was a tradition that of theirs that was surprising, right? But it was a big deal for them to do that. And so I was feeling pretty honored. And we hunted 10 days there with horses with spikes on their shoes in the snow and the ice. And it is a brutal hunt, right?
I would think it would be akin to you and I go hunting doll sheep and I share a doll sheep tenderloin with you, right? We harvest the doll sheep. We cook the tenderloin over the spit on the fire. You got to realize that this is not an everyday nonchalant, oh, we went and got a pork sandwich at the restaurant and they did the dishes. This is a very rare treat that is, that, and it's a high honor.
It was, yes.
And so you've got this experience, you've seen boots on the ground, you've seen conservation in action, you've hunted. Where haven't you hunted?
Yeah, I haven't hunted the North Pole.
So how many species do you have under your belt?
I never went after the North American 29. It was a thing that just was happening and I wasn't paying attention, because one of my favorite species is, say, mule deer or elk. And I do those countless times over and over, 4 or 5 hunts a season of each species just to get enough shows to produce. But I'm at 28 of the 29, and I know that you can't bring the polar bear back into the United States. So I savored that till the end to decide if it was something I really wanted to do. And then I talked to a buddy of mine who told me up there in Pulatuck, the community of about 175 people, he explained they manage their bears and they sell that hide and skull, and that's their source of income.
It's pretty much the sole source of income for the whole community.
It is. And it is U.S. Fish and Wildlife tries to control the number of bears they're going to harvest, but that has no effect on them because people from all over the world go there and hunt and take their trophies home. So I decided I'm going to do it, and I'm going to pull the trigger on that hunt. I leave in 3 weeks, and I'm pretty excited about it because my goal is to show their lifestyle more than the harvest of a bear, but to go out on the ice of the ocean and spend 10 days out there, and it's going to be 20 to 40 below. And it's going to be quite an experience.
And I think you're touching on something. Well, let's not make light of the fact that animals do lose their lives in the pursuit of this, right? However, based on the conservation model, is it better that they all lose their lives with no funding, or one loses its life to pay for the habitat for the other 99? And I'm on board with, hey, let's keep the 99 around and sacrifice one. And it's simply put it with mule deer, put it with white-tailed deer, put it with turkeys. If those turkeys can't pay for their acre of habitat, and it sounds harsh, right? But if that turkey cannot pay with U.S. dollars for that acre of ground, a developer's going to come in, he's going to bulldoze the brush, he's going to pour concrete, it's going to be a condominium, a duplex, a movie theater, or a strip mall, or a warehouse, right?
It's true.
It's happened time and time again. But where we have places around the globe, that you've mentioned a couple of them, Africa's a great example, lots of places here in North America, whitetail are at the highest populations they've ever been.
They are.
Farmers are now.
And it's a problem for a lot of people.
From when you were a kid, it was like the farmers would go out during season and take their 30-30, and they either got a deer or they didn't. Now these guys in the Midwest are actively managing their properties for the highest yield of whitetail deer it will. And because the sportsman's dollars are there to help support that.
And so your question was on the percentage. I'm in agreement with you. So I've got some acreage. I feed many and I harvest few. That's my motto. And that's exactly what we do. We have water troughs we've set up. We've created water out of nothing and planted some alfalfa that'll grow with 10 inches of rain a year. Okay. And they're loving it.
And I know you've got all the sheep species. Sheep are near and dear to my heart. When you talk about water and talk about feeding many and harvesting few, having these diverse, robust wildlife populations, they're now disease resilient, right? If you have a local extirpation for some reason, whether it's predation or bad winter kill or whatever, if you have a robust population spread across the entire range of the habitat, they rebound very quickly.
It's true.
If you're down to one isolated little pocket, black-footed ferret in Wyoming, for one example,
sure,
they get a disease, and the whole colony's gone.
It's done.
It's done. People don't understand, as a fisher and trapper, right? Yes, I want to harvest a few, but I want there to be more next time when I come back.
It's true. Which kind of brings us into the meal aspect of it, right? With the one you harvest or the few you harvest, a moose will feed a family for 2 years. An elk's going to feed a family for a year. And it's lean protein, simple to cook, fast. One of my favorite meals is just take a whole bunch of vegetables, chop them all up, and stir fry your vegetables on one pan. You got your elk steak on the other side with your onions, and you're getting them hot and rolling them around. And then I'll take a little sweet chili sauce and mix it in with the vegetables and flip that over a few times. Pile it all together and everybody digs in. You can't stop eating it. It's just delicious. I don't get that at the restaurant.
You don't get that at the restaurant. And more importantly, if you go to the supermarket and you buy the cellophane wrapped cow, nothing against that, have no problem with that. Marbled fat cow is a delicious steak, but I have no connection to that animal. I have no connection to the land. When I put that plate in front of you, it's like, yeah, here's a meal. When I've taken that backstrap out of the freezer that not only did I harvest, but I backpacked out of the woods, and then I butchered and packaged at home and savored and kept on the perfect top of the shelf and waited, just like the sheep herder did, right? When you come over, I'm like, hey, I think I got one more package of elk backstrap. Rick's here. We're going to have stir fry, and we're having my elk backstrap. And then I get to tell you about the hunt.
Oh, yeah.
And the people and the time and the experience. And now it's almost like I get to relive it and share it with you again. And people who look at us and go, he's just gripping, grinning with a trophy and he's a bloodthirsty killer, they need to dig a little deeper and look a little bit closer at who we are and what we are and why we do the things we do.
Couldn't agree more.
I'm really excited for your polar bear hunt. I really am. It's something that is a little bit out of my means, capability, or reach. So I'm going to live vicariously through you.
Right on.
And watch along.
And I'll certainly share that stuff with you. But don't say never, okay? Because there was a time I said never, and here I am booked to go.
For number 29.
Yeah. And you can do things like get on short lists. Be the guy that's waiting in the wings that can drop your stuff and go when the outfitter calls and says, you know what? Chuck is not able to make his hunt. His deposit's going to the next hunter that'll take it. Rick, you're on the short list. What do you want to do? When's the hunt? Got 30 days. I'll take it.
I would concur with you. I said never about Cape Buffalo my first time in Africa. It's filmed, it's done, and it's an experience that I will relish the rest of my life.
Prime example.
You've done there, you've been it, you've chased the Black Death, and
they've chased me.
Yes, they've chased you. To go stare death in the face,
right,
and that's what you're doing, and live to tell about it, whether it's a doll sheep hunt scaling a cliff, whether it's a polar bear hunt freezing your every digit off, right?
I can share stories forever. And the beauty about the television, they're all captured. All I got to do is watch one show and I can tell the whole story again, right? But I got a few stories that I remember well. And it's risky out there, especially when you're putting yourself in the hands of somebody you don't know. And the last thing you want to do is go to camp and tell them how to do it. So you go to camp and you learn how they hunt in their area and you absorb and you take everything that you learn from them and everything you learn from another outfitter and you keep piling all that up. Pretty soon you can take your experiences and create a better hunt no matter where you go because you're applying everybody else's knowledge into a different region and it works.
I would 100% agree. I do want to touch on one piece, and that's as you've hunted around the globe, helicopters, Sikorskis, Russia, different languages, different people. Safety is a huge piece and factor. And we've talked about personal locator beacons. Your mind is your most important tool when you're out there, right? You got to keep yourself safe. Don't just rely on your guide, but you also need to listen and understand that some things that you're used to doing in Arkansas or Alaska or Hawaii aren't going to work in the Arctic or Africa.
Sure.
So what would you say about safety? What's probably your scariest experience outdoors?
You got a list of them, but there was a time I was on a do-it-yourselfer hunt in in Alaska, Mount Susitnu, and with a buddy of mine. We flew in on a Super Cub, landed, and we're hunting moose in the rut. And in Alaska, you got to take a pretty good-sized moose to be legal, 50 inches or 4 brow ties. We're studying a moose for quite a while, couldn't determine if it was legal. Finally, the light turned just right, and I noticed that he was legal, so I toasted him. We get down there, and he's a monster, okay? He's 70 inches. But at that distance, we were unsure, and it was snowing. So the moose is on the ground, and I'm going to go ahead and start to cape him out. And to be safe, my buddy takes the feet and the back, and he's going to work the hide, and I'm going to start caping the front half. And as I inserted the knife and cut the animal in half, basically, the cut wasn't started dead center of the spine. So I came back, inserted the blade into the existing cut, and was going to push the handle away from me and just nip the hide an extra inch. And I had so much power onto that blade, but I didn't realize it, how much energy I was pushing on it. And when it popped and it cut that hide, my chest fell forward over the animal and my knees were in snow.
So your hands are cold, you're sweating, you're trying to get this moose worked up in grizz country. I'm trying to bring the viewer.
There's already brown bear around us.
Yes. Okay?
And there's blood everywhere. And so as I'm on my knees in the snow with rubber rain gear and the knife powers forward, my chest falls over the top of the animal, the knife comes back and stabs my leg and cuts my femoral artery. And through insulated clothing, hunting pants, and rain gear, it's still pumping 10 inches out with every heartbeat.
Every heartbeat, you got 10-inch spurt of blood coming out of your leg.
And that's with my hand over it.
In grizzly bear country, with grizzly bears around,
right,
laying next to a moose. This is not good.
No, you got 3 minutes and your blood out. That's a fact. We'd already taken all of our gear to the camp and we're coming back for the moose. So all we had was backpacks, rifle, and paracord. And I said to Steve, I need a tourniquet. And I rolled my leg out and he ripped the clothing open, saw the big hole, put 3 tourniquets on me. I asked for my water, drank my water, put my feet up on the moose to elevate my legs, and I passed out. And
felt like seconds, right?
Yeah, it's quick. And my buddy leaves, goes to the plane, leaves me for dead. My eyes are rolled back, leaves me for dead. It's a mile and a half back to the plane or camp, gets on the radio. He knew the National Guard's phone number direct because his girlfriend worked there. So he called him up and said, hey, I'm on Mount Susitnu. Here's my coordinates. We need help. And the crew had come in. It was on a Thursday. They'd come in to do a drill like they do every Thursday. And the storm was so bad that visibility was so low, they canceled their drill for the day, and they actually hung out for 30 minutes and hadn't left. Had they left and drove home, we wouldn't have been able to get them to go for the flight. They said, we'll take the call. The weather's bad. They all jumped in their Pavehawk with FLIR system working, recording the whole flight. So that's some really cool footage. And they're flying between 4 to 18 feet off the ground the whole way.
Because remember, it's snowing.
It's snowing. And they're flying, they have to fly by line of sight, okay, to be legal. And in the video, you see the willows weaving back and forth from the rotor wash. And you see a moose run one direction. And they're talking rudder right, tail left, up this, up that, trying to fly this thing by sight.
10 feet off the ground.
Yeah.
Because it's that nasty.
Yeah, there's 2 pilots, a flight engineer, and 2 medics on board. And they're talking on the radio as if they're going to rescue my friend, not me. They assume I'm dead. And as they approach, it's a long flight for them, as they approach, they warned him to get back from his airplane, even though they would attempt to land in a safe spot, but the rotor wash is going to flip his Super Cub over. That was the concern. And so he did. He got back, and they landed, and he jumped on board, and they said, okay, so where's your buddy? Where's Rick Young? And he said, Rick had tied ribbon every 50 yards on the willows from the moose to the plane so that we'd walk a straight line. All we can do is follow that. Okay, they can't see, but Because the rotor wash, if you can envision the rotor wash blowing the footprints away, you got nothing to go by but a little ribbon, right? Every now and then. Now I'm back there on the moose. I wake up and I got the sounds of a bear around me. I have my gun only because when I asked Steve for my rifle, he thought I was going to shoot myself. But that I said, no, man, I ain't going to shoot myself. I'm not hurting that bad. Give me my gun because I'm going to be out here and there's a bear. And so the bears they pop their jaw when they're coming in. And so I wake up and I realize, hey, I'm still here. I'm freezing to death. I can no longer even move my leg. My hands are blown up. If you take a latex glove and fill it with air and imagine that's your hands, that's how they felt. I had no feeling. They were blown up. And I needed to do something or I was going to die. It was plain and simple. So I pulled myself up on the moose, got lightheaded, and passed back out and went sliding back down. And I said, okay, I wake up again. That ain't happening. I couldn't even untie the tourniquet if I wanted to, but I needed to get a little blood to my feet or my foot or I was going to lose my leg. But that's really risky. So I thought if I could untie it with the dexterity of my fingers, I could retie it, right? Give it a little bit of juice and then tie it back up. I couldn't untie it. My fingers wouldn't work. Eventually, I hear the sound of a whine, a high-pitched whine that's in the distance, and I have no idea if I'm just making this up or if something's happening, right? And it would come and go, and it would come and go. And then all of a sudden, just like in the show you're all familiar with, MASH, how the rescue helicopters come up over the hill, and it's that scene in the open. That's what happens is this giant Huey, Pavehawk, comes straight up from the hill ridgeline out about 50 yards from me. And there was no whoop. There was none of that because he was too low to the ground. I later learned that when they're that low to the ground, they don't create that noise till later. Okay. So they lift up. They see me in the FLIR system because I'm like waving, right? I'm like, I'm right here, fellas. And they go, holy, holy shit, right? And there he is. He's alive. So they land, they throw me on the Stokes. I'm tall. Stokes are only 6 feet long, so I'm hanging over. They throw me into the back of the helicopter. I slam my head against the wall on the other side. They lock it in. We take off. And the guy unties my tourniquets, a mistake, right? The blood starts pumping. He's got his back up against the ceiling. He's got his palm on my groin, and he's bending me in half trying to stop the blood. And it's some serious pressure to get it to stop. And I'm in labored breathing. Audio on the radio is coming from the hospital saying, what's the patient's condition, all this. And they are so busy trying to fly and take care of me that they ignore the hospital throughout the whole flight. And I looked up, I was paramedic in the fire department, so I know what's happening. I look up and there's an oxygen mask hanging in the ceiling. I have no idea if it's even turned on. And I grab it with one hand and I put it on my mouth because I was sucking for air, big time. Next thing I know, I think I passed out again. Next thing I know, they're on the rooftop of the hospital in Anchorage. And they throw me on the Stokes. And of course, they had cut my clothing all the way off, basically. And the blood clots from my toe all the way up to my back are like an inch and a half thick. My whole leg, all the way. It's just that liver look of quack blood.
On the outside of your leg?
On the outside, yeah. And they throw me on the gurney and they're rolling me in the hospital. And my buddy's following. And he said, Rick, he said, it looked like a horror movie. All your blood was splatting on the floor of the white tile going in. He says, it was gross. And they get me into this room. All of a sudden, there's 8 or 9 people around me. They're trying to establish IVs in both arms at the same time, and there's no blood pressure. My blood pressure is 50 over undetectable, and my heart rate is thumping at 160-something, okay? So I'm struggling to exist.
The pump's out of fluid.
And
they've
got nothing in the arms. They're just repeatedly, panically sticking me. Surgeon walks in. I don't know, it's a surgeon. He walks in and he immediately says, we got to do something now. and he stabs my femoral artery on the other side to get some Ranger's lactate going. And he can't get anything back. He doesn't realize that he's actually in the artery. And the only reason I know this is because when your artery is stuck with a needle, it stings for 2 minutes. It's not like a vein, it hurts. So I'm thinking, I need this. And I had not begged for anything, no pain medication or anything, but they were thawing me out with heat, trying to get me warmed up. My temperature was 92 degrees, and they were trying to warm me up, and I was stinging like needles. Your hands start to, the needles in your hands when you're thawing out. My whole body was needles, and I was freaking in pain.
Probably the fact that it was that cold is the reason you're still here.
That's exactly what the doctor said. So then the surgeon gives up on the IV in my leg, and he comes up and he grabs me by both ears and he said, listen, says, I'm going directly into the aorta on your heart. I'm going in under your collarbone and I'm going to get an IV established. If you move, we're going to puncture your lung.
I'm taking this big needle, I'm going to stab it in your heart.
This
Don't
needle's
move.
10 inches long, right? Oh. And it's big bore stuff.
You know how much I hate needles? I think I just said, just let me go. I hate needles, Rick.
So he starts running it in, and I'm on a stainless table that's really narrow. And he's pushing me off the table with pressure, and the nurse has got two hands on my ribs, and she's keeping me from sliding off the table. And he goes, he gets the blood, and he goes, got it. Anesthesiologist, I said, man, I need something for the pain. He says, we can't give you anything because you don't have enough blood. We'll kill you if we give you anything. You're on your own. Let's go. And away we went. They cut my leg a little more, got in there and tied the artery up together. What saved my life was many things, but what saved me was the artery was a sidewall injury. Normally, a fully cut artery retracts and shuts off. Sidewall injury is the most dangerous, but it was trickling blood to my feet, okay? So it saved my leg, but I don't know that. So I wake up in bed after the surgery, and I'm puking over the edge of the bed, and the light's off. I don't know anything. I just feel like I'm roll over and puke. And I'm waking up, and I remember what's going on, and I slowly glance down to see if I got a leg. I'm looking for an amputated leg, and both feet were sticking up. So I said, woohoo, thank God. Yeah, so the surgeon later, because we made a whole show on this, the surgeon later told me that they didn't give me any blood for a reason. You get a reverse shock effect. In laboratory animals, they would drain them over, they'd drain them 50% of their blood, wait an hour, and readminister their own blood. And 50% of those rats died from reverse shock. So he knew that going in. I had no idea, you know, I mean, I owe that guy my life.
Well, I think getting your tourniquet on, I think drinking your water, I think having a buddy who had, there's like 100 things here that lined up to be perfect to you be right. Sitting here today and talking to us. I appreciate you telling us the story. Guys, you gotta keep your heads on a swivel while you're out there. You gotta stay safe. We lose sportsmen every year.
True.
But yep. What I also would say is it's more dangerous getting in your car driving to the airport than it is going out in the field. So we're gonna have a opening ceremony here in just a few minutes, but to wrap it up, I wanna talk about your product and where it came from. Give us the spiel and the pitch and how people can find it.
You bet. I appreciate that opportunity. So over the years of hunting, got a speaker going here, a little bit of music. Hope that's still working. But over the years of hunting, my job was to promote everybody else's product. And in the meantime, I'm coming up with some ideas, right, that I think would work well. And we all know that binocular harnesses stretched out. The old Bino Buddy system would stretch out. They were twisted to put on, they vibrated in the wind, there were a lot of issues. I created this ultralight harness that is a single point of adjustment. And when you adjust the harness, it hugs you, it doesn't hang on you. So you don't need the wide strap. You can eliminate that with a small round cord that's a stout cord. And it hugs you and it holds your binos tight, and yet you can lift them to your eyes without any resistance. And then along comes the chest pack binocular harnesses. Everybody thinks they need one of those. And maybe they do. But if they give this system a try, they'll find out that the binoculars don't fog up because they're already acclimated. The covers I make are 1 ounce. The harness is 1 ounce. You can wear the harness 5 different ways on your body. Women love it. African guides love it because they can put it on their hip rather than their chest. And they eliminate all the heat and sweat. And one thing I'll point out is binocular harnesses contain a lot of sweat, which is bacteria, and it stinks. Listen, for you listeners out there, wash your cover because you're washing your clothing, you're trying to control your scent, but you're not even thinking about this big bag on your chest that's full of bacteria and it stinks something terrible. So if nothing else comes out of this interview, clean your binocular bag, right?
And you and I know elk hunting, the most important thing is wind. The second most important thing is wind. And the third most important thing is wind.
Boy, that's a fact.
Camo don't really matter.
It doesn't. Yeah,
blue movement jeans and which call you're using doesn't really matter. But if they smell you, you're game
done.
Over.
You can even get away with movement. It's just, but if they smell you, you're done. So the other, real quick, the other thing that I patented was shooting sticks. Everyone. That allow you to glass on them. They only weigh 8 ounces. They fold up nice. They're not tent tubes. They're made out of a 7075 aluminum. It's stiff, it's stout, a really creative hinge that you don't fight on the spread, a nice carry pack. This thing is for the guy that hunts and understands it. It's not for the guy that's gotta have the trigger stick or the 3.5 pound system or the 10 pound system where you're operating out of the truck. This is for the guy that walks. He walks the walk and talks the talk and hunts. And this thing works. And I just appreciate the opportunity to tell you guys.
Where can people get a hold of that and find that stuff?
Sure, at rickyoungoutdoors.com. It's real easy. Just rickyoungoutdoors.com. I'm sure if you just type in Rick Young, it'll pop up.
We will look forward to having another episode because we're going to follow up on this polar bear adventure.
Sounds great.
Thanks for joining me, Rick.
There's the national anthem. Let's join it.
Thanks again for listening to the Radcast Outdoors podcast. We hope that you've enjoyed the show. If so, please go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Carbon TV, YouTube, or wherever you're listening to this podcast and subscribe, share, and give us a 5-star rating, which helps other people find the show. You can find all of our shows, recipes, giveaways, videos, and much more at radcastoutdoors.com. Please don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We also have a Radcast community on Facebook called Radcast Nation. We'd love for you to join in the conversation there. And of course, please help support our sponsors who make this show possible. Thanks again to PK Lures, Bow Spider, and High Mountain Seasonings. Until next time, get out there and enjoy the outdoors.